Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, an enormous amount of sound and fury signify nothing might be a good way to describe, to paraphrase Shakespeare, might be a good way to characterize what happened last night. George W. Bush, the State of the Union address.
Keeping America competitive requires affordable energy. And here we have a serious problem. America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world.
So oil man George W. Bush, the son of oil man George Herbert Walker Bush, the president with Vice President and oil man Dick Cheney, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who has a oil tanker named after her, just figured out after 5 years that America is addicted to oil. Gee, what a surprise. America's addicted to oil. Gee. And maybe we should do something about that, because maybe if we didn't have to import all that oil from the Middle East, we wouldn't have to go to war in the Middle East. At least in the minds of the Bush administration. I mean, you know, you got to keep in mind priorities and all that kind of stuff, right? I mean, it's just, you know, what's really important here?
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, George W. Bush, first of all, he makes it sound like we're importing all our oil from the Middle East, and therefore we have to be there. The reality is that we're importing most of our oil from sources very close to the United States, Mexico, Canada, Venezuela. Secondly, if you look at our total consumption of imported oil, it's now $25 billion a year. That's going to the Persian Gulf states. And but if you look at the time from when George Bush came into office, we were importing 58% of our oil from other countries, including, you know, depending on whose numbers you're using, roughly around 20% from the Persian Gulf. 58% of our oil coming in 2000 when Bush came into office. Now it's 66%. We have increased our dependence on foreign oil. Now, George W. Bush, in a speech, I'd have to guess about 6 or 8 months ago, in my recollection, and perhaps my callers or somebody in the chat room can give me the exact date, came out, and I don't recall if it was a speech or a press conference, but he made this outrageous statement that no president in the history of the United States, until he came along, had had an energy policy. That it had never been done. That this was part of the reason why Dick Cheney, meeting with all these oil industry barons, the robber barons of the oil industry, why it had to be behind closed doors and why they went all the way to the Supreme Court to defend their right to keep these meetings secret from we, the people who pay their salaries. Because nobody ever had an oil, an energy policy in the United States before. This, of course, was another one of Bush's lies. As Jimmy Carter pointed out on July 15th, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And Jimmy Carter was actually moving us in that direction. The late 70s and the early 80s, as a result of Carter's policies, we saw an increase in the efficiency of fuel efficiency of vehicles. We saw an increase in conservation all around the United States. We saw, you know, the homes being well insulated and that sort of thing. We saw a decrease in the consumption, in the overall consumption level, brief, but we saw it there. And we saw an explosion in the solar power industry and alternative heating industries. I remember when we first moved to Vermont, we were looking around at homes. This was back 12 years ago when Louise and I first moved to Vermont, where we lived for 10 years. And we ended up buying a house in Northfield, and we were looking all over the state at houses. We had been living in Atlanta for 13 years before that, and we kept finding these houses that were totally passive solar. They were, you know, on a hillside pointing south, all solar. Some of them, a couple of them actually off the grid. They were all built in the late 70s. Why? Because Carter gave tax credits for that. He was encouraging that. We were moving in that direction. In fact, here's the ultimate irony. You got Dick Cheney saying Iraq has 10% of the world's oil supply. You have the United States importing about 20% of its oil from this, from unstable countries in the Middle East. And therefore, Cindy Sheehan's son and another over 2,000 young men and women have died in Iraq. You have all that going on. Keep in mind, the 20% number, Jimmy Carter.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Now, you tell me which president had an energy policy and which one didn't. I mean, this is just, when I heard George W. Bush say that last night, I just, it's so boggled my mind that the level of deceit that the Republicans have been putting forward in this country for so many years had reached that height. I mean, it was just, it boggled my mind. The first official act of office that Ronald Reagan did when he became president was to remove the solar panels from the roof of the White House that Jimmy Carter had put there. Ronald Reagan, who rode into the governor's office in California on the back of oil money, California being the only state in the country that doesn't charge oil companies for how much oil they extract from public lands. So the oil companies in California, they're doing very well, thank you very much, and they made Reagan governor, and they helped make him president. And we have had basically no presidents since then, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, Ronald Reagan, no president since Jimmy Carter has had the courage to stand up and say, you know, we have an energy problem here in the United States, and we need to fix it. Well, George W. now is trying to sound like that guy, right? He's trying to sound like he's going to do something. What's his solution? Well, let's have some more nuclear power plants. Amazing. We stand here between two momentous dates, my friends. Yesterday, the State of the Union address. Tomorrow, Groundhog Day. In one, a creature with beady eyes and questionable intelligence tries to tell us the future. In another, we inspect the shadow of a groundhog. Here we are. I want to play some more of these clips. This is another one of the outrages from last night. Health savings
accounts. We will strengthen health savings accounts, making sure individuals and small business employees can buy insurance with the same advantages that people working for big businesses now get.
Now, here's what's really going on. Right now, big businesses have the ability to write off, actually any business does, but only big businesses can afford it, to write off from their taxes the cost of health insurance. When they pay for health insurance for an employee, they can deduct that from their income taxes. And small businesses, you know, many of them are not profitable. There's nothing in it for them to do that. I mean, they're just kind of skating by whatever money is left over the proprietor pays him or herself. So it's not like they're out there looking for tax deductions. And so Bush is saying, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to stop giving that tax break to big employers. We're going to give it to you, the individual. Now, does that mean that the employers are going to say, hey, now that I no longer have to pay $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a year for your health insurance, here's an extra $8,000 a year. Go ahead and buy it yourself. Somehow, I don't think so. I don't think that everybody in America is going to get a raise. But everybody in America is going to be expected to start saving that $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 a year for a good health insurance policy out of their paychecks. Oh, yeah, you can deduct it. You can deduct the taxes that you would have paid from your taxes. But it's like, you know, home mortgage. I mean, that's not free money. What we are seeing is the destruction of the social safety net that was created in the United States by Franklin Roosevelt. They are rolling back the New Deal, my friends, rolling back Social Security. Now, Medicare wasn't part of the New Deal, although it was proposed by Harry Truman. They're trying to roll these things back. Do you get it? It's about the destruction of Roosevelt's programs.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And George W. Bush, keeping to the script last night, doing something about Roosevelt's program, these health savings accounts. Health savings account users are more likely to have difficulty paying medical bills, according to analysis of these programs done by WebMD Medical News. Just very straightforward. HSA cost savings are illusory. As the New Yorker points out, HSA users paid more out-of-pocket costs. Health savings account users are more likely to avoid, skip, or delay health care because of costs. And yes, we're going to make you, the consumer, in charge of your own costs. So when you have a heart attack, you better be looking at the cost of the hospitals as you're dialing 911. Makes a lot of sense. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Indeed, that's what he wants to do. Turn the whole world into one big Texas. Yeah, the oil patch over there and the grill over here. It's a welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. April 28th, 2005. Thanks to, I think it was Thought Police in the chat room. A screen name, of course. One of the folks in our chat room who provided me with this date, April 28, 2005, George W. Bush, in a Q&A with reporters. Bush, this is a problem that's been a long time in coming. We haven't had an energy policy in this country, and it's going to take us a while to become less dependent on foreign sources of energy. And as the left coaster points out, why, oh, why, Mr. Bush, do we not have an energy policy 10 years ago? What was the GOP doing about it in the 90s? Well, what they were doing was they were calling for the end of the Department of Energy. This was part of Newt Gingrich's contract on America, was to eliminate the Department of Energy, remember? Yeah. And Mr. Nuclear Power Industry, Spencer Abraham, former senator, voted against Clinton administration proposals to raise CAFE standards, fund renewable energy technology, and raise fuel economy standards for SUVs. He also voted more than once during the 1990s to eliminate the Department of Energy. Yeah, it has been a long time coming, my friends. It's been a long time coming because the Republicans have brought it to us. Gary in Memphis, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Gary, the screen here says you're conservative, so you go to the front of the line. What's up?
Ask a basic question about whether we should surgically hit these labs in Iran around the new moon of March, or should we wait until something like a dirty bomb goes off?
Gary, are you still beating your wife?
Well, see, what I want to do is I want to get the right people and the left people to start talking about the future instead of beating the old horses of the past.
Yeah. Are you still beating your wife?
Well, you know that we're going to hit Iran.
Gary, Iran, are you familiar with the deal that they just cut with Russia? This is the reason why the price of oil went down yesterday.
I think we ought to talk about it.
Iran just cut a deal with Russia where Russia is going to reprocess their uranium. So there's no question, number one. Number two, I assume that if you're aware of that, you're also aware of the fact that even if Iran started reprocessing uranium, they're 5 to 10 years away from making a bomb. Number three, I assume you know that Pakistan, the military dictatorship, has the bomb.
The deal happened with Russia just yesterday?
Yeah. Say what?
How come it didn't come out on the news any?
Well, that's where I read it.
So supposedly all this training that's going on in all these bases... This isn't going to happen then, huh?
Well, I think that the Bush administration feels that they have to have a war in order to win elections. And we saw this in 2002. They had to be out there thumping their chests and playing the macho bully boy and, you know, to try and win the 2002 elections. And it was that vote on the war that allowed, for example, Saxby Chambliss to beat Max Cleland, if that actually happened in the state of Georgia and in other places.
Reagan's steaming to right now?
Say that again?
The USS Ronald Reagan that took off from California on the 4th
yeah.
of January.
Yeah, see, I think this is the war for the 2006 election.
But it's not a war. It's going to be like a surgical strike. No.
Well, yeah, you know, it'll be, if that happens, we'll see. But Ronald Reagan did this very well, too. You know, pick a small country that can't fight back and, take them out. Let's go after Panama. Let's go after Grenada. Let's go after, that kind of thing. Although Iran, frankly, can fight back. And I think
that it's better to wait and see if something bad happens instead of stopping them ahead of time.
No, it's better to work with them, bring them into the community of nations. Help them, bring them into the United, well, they are in the United Nations, have the UN Security Council work with them, threaten them on the one hand with sanctions, which the UN Security Council is doing, and on the other hand, offer to work with them. I am assuming, Gary, that you know who created the Iranian nuclear program in the first place.
Oh, yeah, we started it up. We helped them when the Shah was still going in there.
Right, right, and you know why?
Because we were trying to get a foot in the Middle East.
Well, in part because at the current pumping rates, they've got about 25 years worth of oil left, and then they run out. And so they're drinking this Kool-Aid, and nuclear power is good.
The reason we took out Saddam was not oil. It was because if we'd left him alone, he would have hit Tel Aviv within anywhere two, three years after he'd gotten all this stuff together.
Saddam was not getting the stuff together, number one. And number two, Tel Aviv can take care of itself. Thank you very much. And number three.
He was paying everybody off.
Number three, we took out Saddam because George W. Bush wanted to get political capital. He wanted to win elections, very simply. That's just the bottom line. Luke in Grand Rapids, you think I'm misrepresenting HSAs?
Yes, I do.
Go for it.
Well, I'm personally enrolled in an HSA program, and the quality of care hasn't changed. I used to be enrolled in 100% care. I didn't have any. Well, I had the copay. I never had to worry about coinsurance, and I'm in the healthcare industry. And
but now you get to set aside part of your own income to pay for your own deductibles, but it's tax deductible, right?
It's tax deductible. I get to build this up. I can now, if I build this up, and I've got two kids that have, one has had kidney surgery. I mean, they had some big bills last year, which have been great. It would have been kind of hard with it.
What's your income, Luke?
About 40.
Okay. Do you think somebody working at Walmart could do this?
I think it's something that you could.
You're raising two kids on $40,000 a year, and you have enough money to set aside in a health savings account?
That's the problem. I've been investing in this for the last year when it came out, and I'm excited because.
How much money's in your HSA, Luke?
Why don't you listen to me for a second? Are you going to a break?
Yeah, we are.
Can I come over for the next one?
Yeah, sure. Hang on. Fascinating. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Conservatives coming out of the closet here all over the place. It's wonderful. It's the Tom Hartman Radio. Actually, Luke, I think that, we got Mark Wilson coming on in just a minute. We're going to be talking with Mark Wilson, who's going to be running against Maria Cantwell in the state of Washington. We'll pick up your calls after that. 27 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We ain't asking you to love us. You've been playing yourself high above us. Mr. President, get it on the working man.
Oh, Mr. President, let's help out the working man here. It's tragically not going to happen. George Bush made it very clear last night it wasn't going to happen. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. We had a vote earlier in the week on cloture, on breaking a filibuster that would have prevented Sam Alito from being on the Supreme Court. It was interesting last night to watch on the Chris Matthews show, as is so often the case on MSNBC, Jeff Cohen, who was the former producer for Phil Donahue's show, told me that his instructions from MSNBC were any time that you have a guest, you have to have a conservative guest, and if you have a liberal on, you must have two conservatives. Or any time you have a liberal on, you have to have a conservative to balance them. And if you have a big-time liberal like Michael Moore, you have to have two conservatives on to balance them. Well, last night, Chris Matthews, he had uber-conservative slash Nazi Pat Buchanan and Joe Scarborough. which probably the same designation. And these guys are gloating. They were saying, you know, Sam Alito being on the court, this is going to change America. You have no idea, because his question was, you know, what's the significance of the State of the Union address? And they're like, you know, State of the Union address is meaningless. The court has just turned. And Maria Cantwell, one of the senators that voted to allow Sam Alito onto the Senate by breaking the filibuster that would have prevented him from getting onto the Senate, which has raised the ire of a lot of folks in the state of Washington. And this is symptomatic of things that are happening all across the United States. Mark Wilson in Washington is running against Maria Cantwell in the primary. His website, votemark.org. I spent some time on Maria Cantwell's site this morning as well, by the way. And you can visit her website at cantwell.senate.gov. And looking for specific issues, I couldn't find any, though. Maybe I didn't spend enough time. In any case, Maria Cantwell has been on this program before, and I have a lot of respect for her. I think she's a good person. But some folks in Washington are questioning whether she's actually representing Washington State. Mark Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Mark, one of our listeners sent me an email saying that she says, I think you're one of the top talk show hosts, and obviously more into blah, blah, blah. I listen on a daily basis. I'm absolutely shocked this morning to hear you talk against Maria Cantwell. You have the power to destroy her by talking about her in less than fair terms. She's been a brave and good senator for our state. She's been down this road before when she served in the House and stood up for better gun laws, defeated the next election. My hope is that we will look at the larger goal of seeing more Democrats elected so we can stop George W. I would also like to tell you Maria does not take money from any PAC. Well, good on Maria Cantwell for that. Why, Mark Wilson, would you risk bruising a sitting Democratic senator like Maria Cantwell in such a critical time for this country?
Well, that's a fair question, and it's really based on my perception after being out to about 60 different Democratic events throughout the state, finding that instead of passionate support for reelection of the incumbent, that the party is already split, even absent my presence in this effort. And it's not just the vote for the war, but even more so just recently, a week ago Thursday, she said that she had absolutely no regrets about the war vote, which is a tragedy. And then, of course,
the Iraq war vote.
Exactly. And, of course, now with cloture and, in fact, securing a spot on the bench for Sam Alito, it's not just a woman's right to choose, but the possibilities of a reversion to the 1937 interpretation of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution that could have dramatic, far-reaching impacts.
Right. It would do away with the Endangered Species Act. It would do away with a lot of the EPA's functions. It would do just in broad brush. I mean, it's a, But I don't think that we can lay responsibility for Sam Alito at Maria Cantwell's door. I mean, she has done some good things, has she not?
You know, absolutely. But, again, my goal is to retain this important seat. And you'll remember, Tom, it was only a 129-vote difference that separated our governor's election in 2004. We can be very close on elections statewide. In fact, in 2000, when Senator Cantwell was elected, the margin of victory was only 2,200 votes. So these are statistical dead heats, and it really shows that in order for us to be successful at protecting this important seat, we need the unified effort of everyone within the party, and even have to go further. We need to reach to third parties as well and find resonance and issues that will actually help them to engage with us in defending this seat.
We're talking with Mark Wilson, votemark.org, his website. He's running for against Maria Cantwell in the Democratic primary, which will be this fall or late summer in the state of Washington for the 2006 election. He's a Marine Corps veteran, the son of a veteran. He's the father of two veterans, a union member, a former commercial fisherman, small business owner. And your website just comes right out and says, you want to bring an immediate end to all of our nation's ill-conceived, costly adventures in Iraq, protect Social Security, oppose NAFTA, CAFTA, the WTO, repeal Taft-Hartley, direct a half of our weapons spending to moving away from fossil fuels and developing renewable energy, refocus our troops on national defense. You know, some folks, Mark, I think might say, wait a minute, is this guy one of those wacko lefties who uses phrases like the Bush crime family, or is he a serious contender who can actually take on and be part of the Democratic Party?
Well, I'm certainly finding that the momentum in the last 48 hours is certainly with me. And I believe that the blue-collar, common-sense working background, the practical experience that I have, is really much more representative of the people of the state of Washington and, in fact, of the Democratic Party. And I'm enjoying a tremendous amount of support. The outpouring has been just phenomenal. So I have to say, yes, I believe that I am viable and representative of the folks here in Washington State who really are much more ahead of the curve than, unfortunately, our leaders on some of the most important issues, particularly the war, but on energy policy and liberty as well, the Patriot Act. We certainly don't have to trade away our liberty to be more secure. And it's appalling to see that even in the State of the Union address that George Bush just never fails to exploit military families to try to legitimize this immoral tragedy in Iraq.
Mark Wilson, if you don't win this primary, will you support and work for Maria Cantwell to be reelected in 2006?
Well, I'm certainly determined that we do everything in our power to retain this important seat. So absolutely, I will support the party's nominee.
Yeah, okay, great. Now, on your website, you point out that Maria Cantwell voted for the Patriot Act, for NAFTA, for CAFTA, voted for the confirmation of Condi Rice, the confirmation of John Negroponte, in favor of moving class action lawsuits from state into federal courts, making it harder for working families to sue big corporations. She voted for the energy bill. That's quite a list, quite an indictment, frankly. Why do you think she took those positions? Is in your mind, is she that conservative, or are there, you know, is this the problem that so many people have and that you would have if you were elected to the United States Senate? Of, you know, where you get your money from to run an election? It costs $6-8 million, in some cases $10 million, to run for the United States Senator these days.
Well, that's exactly the point, and that's why we need profound, fundamental changes in our electoral process in order to really open up the system so that ordinary citizens can participate, so that we don't have to sell our soul to the corporations that are in fact plundering the Earth's resources. We need to restrain and control and make sure that working families have a chance to enjoy a peaceful and progressive life, and that their children's future has hope and real meaning. I think that not just that indictment, but looking at the division within the Democratic Senate regarding cloture, you'll see that it was that 25 who voted for it, therefore assuring that Sam Alito would sit on the bench in the nation's highest court, that the division among career politicians in the Senate particularly is such that corporations really, you know, he who pays the piper eventually calls the tune. So the influence of big money in politics is really destroying really the planet and the opportunities for working families to have a chance at a reasonable life.
We're talking with Mark Wilson. He's taking on Maria Cantwell in the Washington State primary. We're going to be talking to other candidates as well. There's an interesting race going on in Pennsylvania. Just profiling and highlighting some of these things, I think it's good for our discussion. Let's bring in a couple of listeners here, and that we've got about 2 minutes to go. Caroline in Everett, Washington. You're live and on the air, Caroline.
Hi. Good morning, Tom. I am a 2-year listener of your show, and I just love it. Can you hear me?
I can. You're calling from Everett, Washington, right?
Okay, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Maria Cantwell. I am really, really upset with her vote the other day.
But just, is just one vote enough to cause you to turn away from a candidate?
No, it was a 2-vote. One was a CAFTA.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
I could have forgiven her for that vote, but I cannot forgive her for Alito, that filibuster.
Yeah, I got it, Caroline. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Marcia in Linwood, Washington. Quick comment, Marcia, and then we'll get Mark's comment, and we'll wrap this thing up.
Oh, good morning.
We have 30 seconds here.
Am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, yes. I just wanted to let you know, as a lifelong Democrat and as a Democratic precinct officer here in Snohomish County, I will never, ever support Maria Cantwell, and I will, in fact, I will support a Republican opponent. Because
please don't do that, Marcia. Please do not support a Republican opponent. I'm telling you, work to get, a progressive elected, and if a progressive is not elected, let's bring Maria Cantwell back to the Senate, because the first vote that any politician makes is the vote for leadership. And the fact of the matter is that Maria Cantwell is a Democrat. We have to have a majority of Democrats in the United States Senate. Mark Wilson, votemark.org. Mark, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Tom.
Great talking to you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Why me, George? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown? Tell me, George, what did I ever do for a whiz kid like you to bring chaos to my home?
Yeah, I'd like to know.
Lord, help me, Jesus. We didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here.
Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And, Luke, we were talking with you about HSAs.
Right.
And you were, and we have very little time here. Give me in just a couple of sentences why you're so happy that you now have the ability to save up money to pay the deductibles on a high deductible insurance program.
I'll tell you why.
Out of your own money.
It's all about numbers. I've heard your radio spots on, you know, if Bush wants Social Security to go this way, he's going to 5% as opposed to 3%. I understand the argument, so let's look at math. I spend $2,000 a year in premium, and then I spend another $500 or $800 in copays and prescription medicine. So I spent like $3,000 last year, and I don't get to keep that money back.
And your employer spent how much?
My employer spent about $4,000.
Okay, so we got a total $7,000 health insurance
bill.
George W. Bush wants to say to your employer, you can no longer deduct the cost of health insurance for Luke. So Luke is now going to have to pick up the whole $7,000.
No, I don't think it's the way you're
going to get that money.
Let me push this out before you start typing the way the program is. I don't have now any contributions coming out of my payroll now for that, and now I use that money to go into my HSA program. I can only put up to $1,600 into my program.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing Luke.
Are you there?
Yeah, okay, I got you now.
Now it's all a math. I don't put my money now $2,000 into premium anymore. My company takes care of my side of the quotient, but I
They do that because they have the ability to deduct that from their income taxes.
And slow down.
But George W. Bush wants to change that. He wants to put them.
Let me finish my equation here. I paid $2,000 in premium last year plus all my copays and co-insurance. Now I get all the discounts from the provider from my carrier, but now I only spend $1,600 because my company gives me $500 towards my deductible. So now all of my other costs go through the loop. The claim is sent to my carrier, then they send back remittance to the provider, then the provider sends back to me. It's a month and a half before I get it, and then if I want to, if I have the money in my checking account, I can just spend it off if I want to. Otherwise, I have a debit card I can use off that account.
Wouldn't it be a hell of a lot easier, Luke, instead of running this money through a bank that's going to charge you fees for this thing and running it through an insurance company that's taking 15 or 20% off the top from this thing and these for-profit hospitals so Bill Frist's father can become a billionaire? Wouldn't it be a lot easier simply if Medicare covered everybody in the United States? Total overhead cost, 2%.
It would, Tom, but I don't think that we need 30% in taxes every year. I think we do better.
It would not cost 30% in taxes. It would cost 30% in taxes if it was being run through the health insurance companies right now, Luke. But if it was being run through Medicare, it would not cost anything close to that.
We don't have the workforce to support all that without increasing the tax base and allowing our politicians now use.
Luke, the workers are already paying for it. We have the most expensive health care in the world. We spend twice as much per capita than any country in the world, and yet we still have 45 million people.
There's a reason why, because we are the leading country when it comes to.
No, we're not.
Yes, we are.
We're not. We are in the 20s and 30s, depending on the index that you use for quality of life and health in the world compared to other countries. Every other country with a comprehensive national health care program has a higher standard of living, longer lifespan, lower infant mortality rates. Absolutely, and even the conservatives will agree with that, although they come along and say, well, that's because they don't have as many poor people.
Do you think that the government spends your money better than the consumer can?
Absolutely.
You think that a politician can spend the money better than I can spend?
Absolutely. I want those boring guys with the green eye shades at the Social Security Administration who in 70 years have never once missed a check and have never, ever played all those Enron games out there and have never...
Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah, I would much rather have those boring guys at the Social Security Administration handling my retirement money, and I'd much rather have an equivalent of that over in Medicare handling my financial money than somebody like the guy at HealthSouth, Scrutchy, who was just indicted for a $2 billion fraud.
If you take down the steamer, how long would it take to get it back up?
I mean, this is what happens when you get
something you want to just be
when you get for-profit
off
corporations
yeah,
involved in the commons.
Well,
just go ahead and shut it down. Let's just jack the prices up in California.
I think you're totally misrepresenting the whole program, Tom.
No, I'm not. I got to move along too, Luke. I'm not. Matt in Kansas City, Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think it's completely ironic that George Bush marches out this plan for this health savings account at the same time that we read in the paper that we're saving at the lowest rate that we have since the Great Depression.
Since 1933. We're actually at a negative savings rate, one half 1% minus.
You know, that maybe Luke is an exception, and good for him. I'm glad that he is. But I can tell you that in the Midwest now, people are starting to wake up. People are losing their health insurance left and right. Things are getting tougher and tougher and tougher out here. And I've had people that were ultra-conservative look at me and finally admit, things are not going well.
You're right, Matt. And the simple math is, the simple reality is, the health savings account might be a good deal for somebody who is solidly in the upper middle class. Somebody who's making $60,000, $80,000, $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 a year. Certainly more than $200,000 a year. It's a good deal. It lets you shelter some of your income away from taxes and all that sort of thing, given our current health care system. But somebody making $40,000 a year, I'm sorry, I don't buy it. I don't believe it.
Well, try this one for size, Tom. All right, I make about $60,000 and worked pretty hard to get it, and I had a hospitalization in my family this last year, and my it was about $11,000, and my part of it was $63 because I have a good union job where my employer does take care of me.
There you go, and the good union job is without that the employer wouldn't be doing it. Matt, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's 56 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. You're in the real free speech zone, my friends. No barbed wire. Nobody going to haul you off if you happen to be wearing a T-shirt that says 2,240. How many more are going to die? Actually, Cindy Sheehan's T-shirt didn't even say that. I mean, it wasn't that explicit. It said 2,245 and how many more? ? And for a T-shirt in the gallery, she's in jail. 57 minutes past the hour.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. George W. Bush, weaseling through the State of the Union address, I just don't know a better phrase. I'm sorry.
Appropriate members of Congress have been kept informed.
He's talking about He's been doing it for 3 years, illegally wiretapping Americans without warrants. Appropriate members of Congress. Let's get that again.
Appropriate members of Congress.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Appropriate members of Congress. Interesting. I'm sorry. You can't say that. You're going to rewrite the rules. I mean, a legal analysis by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service concludes that the Bush administration's limited briefings for Congress on the National Security Agency's domestic eavesdropping without warrants are, quote, inconsistent with the law, end quote. This is the Congressional Research Service. This is an arm of Congress that has been there forever. They're nonpartisan. They got nothing to do with politics. They're just saying, sorry, you broke the law. And then, of course, Bush tries to roll out this old chestnut.
Previous presidents have used the same constitutional authority I have.
What he's speaking of, if he's referring to what Scotty McClellan, the only time this has been trotted out, Scotty McClellan rolled it out in a press conference. He said that the Clinton-Gore administration had engaged in warrantless physical searches during the time that FISA was in effect. And this was the case with Aldridge Ames. The CIA, he was a CIA officer, this guy. And there's two interesting things about this. The first was, Janet Reno authorized a warrantless search of Aldridge Ames' home and whatnot, a warrantless physical search. But the law did not prohibit that until 1995, and this was in 1993, number one. And number two, perhaps more important, Aldridge Ames worked for the CIA. When you go to work for an organization like that, you basically say, you know, if you're going to be a spy, if I'm going to be a spy, then, you know, they have the right to check up on me. I mean, you know, have you ever heard of a security and security search? This is just tragic. I mean, the Bush administration would even try and make these kind of claims. And why do they try and make these kind of claims? Well, you got to trot out 9/11, right?
We now know that two of the hijackers in the United States placed telephone calls to Al-Qaeda operatives overseas. But we did not know about their plans until it was too late.
Well, actually, we did know about their plans, and we could have been surveilling them. And in fact, George, August 6th, as I recall, you got a memo saying Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. You got more than 50 specific warnings that this was coming. You could have told airplanes to the airlines to harden their cockpit doors. You could have done it. You didn't do it. You could have stopped this thing. Bush doesn't mention that the government had compiled significant information, this from the Washington Post, on the two suspects before the attack, and that bureaucratic problems, not a lack of information, were the primary reasons for the security breakdown, according to congressional investigators of the 9/11 Commission. And the 9/11 Commission looked into this, and they said the Bush administration had enough information to know that this hijacking was going to happen if they had simply, quote, connected the dots, end quote. The information was there. We didn't need a president breaking the law to get the information. And in fact, now we're discovering that George W. Bush started this illegal wiretap operation before 9/11. And if he was doing it before 9/11 and he says, well, it could have prevented 9/11, it's like, wait a minute, there's a disconnect here. I want to know who the Democratic politicians are or their friends or allies are that the Bush administration has been snooping on. That's what I want to know. Were they listening in on John Kerry? Were they listening in on Hillary Clinton? Were they listening in on Christiane Amanpour's husband, Jamie Rubin? I mean, who are the Democrats that the Bush administration has been listening in on? Moreover, the administration had the power to eavesdrop on their calls and emails as long as it sought permission from the secret court that oversees clandestine surveillance in the United States. The Bush administration could have easily had the NSA listen in on these two hijackers. They could have even done it for 3 days without going to the FISA court and saying, by the way, these are the guys we're listening in on, and here's the reason why. And the FISA court would have given permission. This is just so patently and pathetically trying to pander and scare people. It's the old, you know, 9/11, be afraid. Just, you know, Bush's whole mantra.
September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists. September the 11th. Danger. Doom. Danger.
And the more Bush says it, the more increasingly Americans are not buying it. Increasingly Americans don't even think that this guy's going to keep us safe. Because the biggest national security failure in the history of the United States happened on George Bush's watch.
Be afraid. September, the continuing danger. We have fought the terrorists across the
Condoleezza earth. Rice is in charge of national security, and she completely blew it. They were told by the Clinton administration as they came into power, keep your eye on Osama bin Laden. What did they do? Nothing. Bush made Dick Cheney in charge of the counterterrorism task force, and Dick Cheney and that task force never met before September of 2001. Never met. It was one of the two jobs he was given, that and the energy task force. Well, they were meeting a lot, but you're not allowed to know about that. No, siree, Bob. You can't know about that. Sorry.
Destruction. September the 11th. The Almighty God. Evil God. In Saddam Hussein, we saw a threat. Terror.
This is all, by the way, from Bush's RNC speech. It's just a montage from his RNC speech. Bush overseeing massive deficits. It just goes on and on and on. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. Harry in Dallas, Texas on the line. Hey, Harry, what's on your mind today?
Hello?
Hey, Harry, you're live and on the air.
Yeah, I got a couple of questions. I'm a reservist in the Marine Corps, and I just come back from my second tour from Iraq. And I'm a truck driver in my civilian life, and I'm going to be losing my truck here, and I got creditors coming after me for a lot of stuff. And I borrowed some money from my GI Bill. Do you see anything in the future, any kind of help coming our way for this kind of stuff? Because, I got a family and a couple of kids, and I'm behind on my house payment and everything like that.
Are they coming after you, Harry, because you were unable to earn a living while you were in Iraq? Is that
Yeah, but they I got one creditor coming after me. He, I spent $1,850 of my own money on body armor when I went back for my second time. And they are coming after me like that. They said that I had money to spend on stuff like that. And I told everybody that's what I spent my money on. And now they're coming after me for reimbursements for this and that. And I
who's
can't
they?
Who's they? I got like seven or eight different creditors. My truck that I'm driving, the bank is threatening to take that away.
Yeah.
And
Harry, you know about nonprofit credit counselors?
Yeah, I've called them up.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the for-profit ones where they're basically, you know, trying to hustle you or trying to get you to borrow money from them to pay off your loans, and then you end up in debt to them at a higher interest rates. There's non-profit organizations. Don't charge anything at all, and they don't ask you to borrow any money through them, at least anyway, and that do credit counseling. As far as, you know, that's tragically, that's the best advice I can offer you, because I don't think you're going to get anything out of the Bush administration. I would also strongly suggest that you call your member of Congress. Do you know who represents you in the House of Representatives?
No, I do not know who's out.
Okay. Well, if you call this toll-free number and just give them your zip code, they can tell you who your congressman is or congresswoman. And usually your members of Congress are the ones who are the most, you know, feet on the ground. They're the ones who are the closest to the constituents, and they're the ones who are most able to do things. And so call this toll-free number, 888-355-3588, 888-355-3588. And, you know, find out who your member of Congress is and tell them what's going on. I know that, you know, in Vermont, for example, Bernie Sanders would be all over this. And I know here in Oregon, Peter DeFazio would. So I'd start, you know, with that and with the credit. But, you know, the Bush administration, they got nothing for vets.
Well, I mean, they're talking about my unit going back here. I've been home 6 months, and they're always talking about maybe sending us back here in another 3 to 5 months. I can't afford to take another time like this. And my time's up. I'm due to get out. I went in to turn in my papers to get out, and they told me, sorry, you can't get out.
Right. They call it the stop-loss program.
Yep, the stopwatch is on right now, and I can't get out. I mean, I'm a staff sergeant, and I can't get out, and I was forced to reenlist. Basically, I was told to reenlist, or I'd get court-martialed, so I reenlisted for another 4 years. But I can't afford it again. I just want the American people to know that,
yeah,
you know, the reservists and the National Guard, we're going broke.
Yeah. Yeah, so, a good friend of mine in New Hampshire, the same thing. He spent a year and a half over in Iraq and came back and didn't have his job anymore. And, mm-hmm. You know, I know it's illegal to fire somebody if they're off in military service, but sometimes jobs just move along, you know?
Yep. Well, I'll give that number a call, and I appreciate it. And keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Harry, and you too, and keep spreading the good word, and thank you for your service to our country. It's appreciated by all of us. I know it had to be a tough thing for you, and but what a grim story. And this is, by the way, Harry's story is the story of thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, and maybe ultimately one day hundreds of thousands of Americans. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
What a wonderful, wonderful world this could be.
Indeed, if we would just return to the rational policies of the New Deal. You know, Bill Clinton comes into office, and all of a sudden we've got a surplus, and we start paying down our debt. Democrats just seem to do a decent job of running things. Have you noticed that? I think Americans are starting to get a little nostalgic. Just a minute, we're going to hear from Victoria Jones of Talk Radio News. First, Alice in Humboldt County. Alice, you're going to turn 92 this month?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Alice.
I guess there are people who still believe George Bush cares about us. Thank you for explaining the truth to those who will listen. I wanted to mention that there will be more big demonstrations today. I believe ours will be in front of our courthouse early this afternoon, 12:30.
Okay. Great. Okay. Great. And that's in Eureka, California, where we're on the air in KGOE. Alice, thank you very much.
Have a good day.
Thank you, and you too. And thank you all, and I hope you have a happy birthday this month. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Hey, 91. And she's still protesting?
Yeah, she's turning 92 this month.
Wow.
Alice has been calling this program for 3 years now, going on 3 years. Oh, the program, yeah.
That's outstanding.
She's marvelous. She's one of my heroes, or heroines, whatever's appropriate. Anyhow, Victoria, what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, President Bush is speaking in Nashville, and he's saying that the world is better off without Saddam Hussein, which I don't think anybody actually argues about.
Gee, surprise, surprise.
I know. It's very interesting. And he's saying the Almighty's gift to everybody is freedom.
Now, here's a question, actually, Victoria Jones. Do you think that Iraq is actually better off now than they were when Saddam Hussein was running the country?
No, you see, I think that's a different question.
I know.
I think if you ask the first question, you have to say, yes, it is better off without Saddam Hussein. And when you ask the second question, you have to look at the mess that they're in. I think if we answered it today, we'd say no. If we answered in a year's time, we could say absolutely no, or we could say it's getting to be.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, now Bush has made this mess. He's kicked over this beehive. We've got to put the thing back together to the extent that we can, but that doesn't, in my opinion, the military is not the device to do that. When you've got 80% of the Iraqi people, roughly, saying that they think it's okay to attack American soldiers, that means it's time to bring the American soldiers out. And if you're going to rebuild the country, let's give the money to the Iraqis. They know how to build their own country. They've done it before.
They do know how to build their own country.
However, if
we were to do that, I think you'd hear something from the residents of New Orleans.
Well, we're spending a whole awful lot more on rebuilding Iraq right now than we are on New Orleans.
Exactly. I think that the residents of New Orleans would protest, but they're basically...
But it would be so much cheaper. It would be so much cheaper to simply give the money to the Iraqi contractors, to the Iraqi government, and say, you hire your own local companies, than to hire Halliburton that has to hire Americans for $150,000 a year to go in there.
Well, I mean, don't even get me started on Halliburton.
Yeah, okay. So anyhow, back to what's happening in Washington, D.C.
Well, yes, the main thing is the president speaking in Nashville outside Washington, D.C. I mean, the day after is fairly kind of quiet. I mean, there are a few press conferences that people are having. There are a couple of interesting hearings today. Senate Homeland Security Committee continues its hearings on Katrina. The General Accounting Office has come out with a report saying the federal government was at fault, majorly at fault, and that it really needed to have appointed one person. And it uses the word immaturity in referring to the federal government's response. Also, the Senate Judiciary Committee has a couple of interesting hearings, one on the death penalty and another one on consolidation of energy companies, to which the heads of all the oil companies were supposed to come, and they all said no.
They all said that they wouldn't testify.
That's correct. They're not showing up.
Oh, my. You know why? They don't want to end up in a situation like the tobacco executives when they were called before Congress. And
please consider yourself to be under oath.
Yes or no? Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive, yes. Congressman, cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction.
And on it went. I mean, there was five or six of them, and every single one of them lied through their teeth. None of them suffered any penalty for that. One of them went on to become the president of IBM, but Lou Gerstner.
And, of course, they didn't testify under oath because Senator Ted Stevens in the most recent hearings insisted that they not testify under oath. He's not on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I'm quite sure that Senator Arlen Specter would have made them go under oath.
Right. This being the oil industry executives that you're talking about. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
And so they've weaseled out of this. Is the committee going to issue a subpoena?
As far as I know at this point, they're not. From what I've gathered, they are holding the hearing and they're speaking to various experts, and it seems as though they've given up.
Yeah, they got to preserve their campaign contributions from this industry.
It's a quite extraordinary system, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is indeed.
It is. It really is quite fascinating. Now, there's a rumor going around, and I don't know if it's valid at all, that now that it's after the State of the Union address, President Bush may quietly release the records of his contacts with Abramoff. Just get it out there, because now that Republicans are calling on him to do this, because they've all realized that this is dragging it on and just making him look like he's mired in it, that the quickest thing to do is to get it out. I don't know if that's correct. We certainly have seen no sign of it today.
Well, I understand Abramoff has had more than 200 official visits to the White House. Is that correct?
I believe it's something like that.
Okay. And of course, Ricky Santorum was having these weekly meetings, the K Street Project meetings, in some cases with Abramoff. Has anybody asked Santorum about his contacts with Abramoff?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, well, the Senate needs to be looking at more than just the president, I think, here. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria. Keep up the good work and keep on reporting. We appreciate it. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back, my friends.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Ah, yes, ghost chickens in the sky. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Bush nominee says laws adequate at mines. By the way, our phone number, 866-440-8466, will be coming to your calls in just a second. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll drop you in there. The former mining industry executive who was running the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration resigned. Right, he left his job. And so a new industry executive is being considered to be put in here. This guy, David Lariski, is the guy who resigned. He's a former Utah mining company executive, ran the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration throughout the first term of the Bush administration. He resigned in November 2004. The acting agency head, David Dye, was actually recently criticized by Arlen Specter for leaving a hearing last week on mine safety after he testified, but before other witnesses spoke. Specter wrote a sharp letter to his boss, Labor Secretary Lane Chow, saying Dye and Ray McKinney, another top mine safety official, walked out of the hearing. And he wanted to know whether Chow had told them to walk out. But anyhow, so a new guy, they got another executive, another mine executive, this guy Richard Stickler. This is for the agency that oversees safety in 1,400 coal mines in America. Under sharp, this is from USA Today today, under sharp questioning from Democrats, Stickler declined to endorse new safety measures such as increasing the number of mine rescue teams. Why would that be? Well, because it would increase costs for coal mines. Of course, this guy was a top executive at the West Virginia subsidiary of Massey Energy, one of the nation's largest coal producers. Surprise, surprise. This, by the way, just a few days after this story appeared in Canada.com, the Canadian press, Tim Cook writes, 70 potash miners who took to safe rooms as a refuge from an underground fire waited patiently early Monday morning as rescue crews worked to be able to bring them to the surface. Remember the miners in Canada who safely made it out? The miners who had been on shifts since 7 p.m. on Saturday night reported smoke and then headed for the safe rooms, sealed-off areas that could be as large as 15 by 45 meters and have an internal supply of oxygen that lasts up to 36 hours, along with food, water, chairs, and beds. 2 hours later, teams of six rescue personnel wearing breathing apparatus began to be mobilized, going into the mine for a few hours at a time and coming back out and sending in the next team. After 20 hours after the event began, the fire was finally put out and work was begun on clearing the smoke so that the miners could be brought to safety. We're almost a day later here, but these miners, they're just fine because they've got this safety room where they've got food, they've got water, they've got oxygen, they've got cots, chairs, beds. Hamilton stressed that the mine must be cleared of smoke and toxic gas before the workers could be brought out. He said, they're safe where they are. They're safe in there for many, many hours, potentially even days. Once we're confident the air is clean and safe, then we'll go in there with a mine rescue team and begin transporting them to the surface and home safely to their families. And sure enough, that's what happened. Might add, Gord Hunter, the Communication, Energy, and Paper Workers, the union representing the workers of the mine, said they were also part of the rescue effort. Every mine in Canada has these things. Are there any mines in the United States with safe rooms? No, not one. And now the Bush administration wants to put another crony in charge of another safety institution. I mean, how much can we take? This is how much can we take before America is destroyed by these guys? Cheryl in Arcata, California. Hey, Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, you were talking earlier about this spying that's going on Americans and you know, the president and his justification. And I watched Face the Nation this weekend. I don't know if you saw him on with Bob Schieffer.
Saw who on? George Bush?
George Bush.
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Okay, well, I have this little transcript section that I just thought I'd kind of go over, which I think is just hilarious. It says from Bob Schieffer, "Let me ask you this, Mr. President, because I've never quite understood this, and maybe you could clear this up. As I understand the law, you had the right to wiretap or eavesdrop on anyone and have 3 days to tell the court about it. And how does that slow you down?" Then President Bush responds. He says, "Well, I asked the same question to the people designing the program. I said, how come we can't use the procedures which you just described? And they said it won't work. It doesn't fit in with what Mike Hayden described as hot pursuit." And it says, he says, "I looked at the program from all angles, and my dilemma is..."
Yeah, I did. I did see that show.
Okay.
This was a week or two ago.
Well, actually, it was Sunday.
Oh, was it? Oh,
uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I saw the clip on the news anyway.
Well, and it kind of goes on, which this is the part.
It's like Bush thinks we're idiots.
Well, that is the whole point. And it says, he goes on, it says, "I'm troubled by it because the enemy listens and they see what we're doing, and these are smart people and they'll adjust." Well, FISA court is a secret court. This is not court TV.
Yeah.
And
no, it's pathetic what and I want to know. What I want to know is who is Bush spying on in the United States that he's afraid to go before a judge and talk about? Because I think that there's something Nixonian about this. Who was Bush spying on and why? Frankly, which Democratic politician was Bush? Politicians were Bush spying on? That I think should be the question that every single reporter asks. And so, as far as I know, not one single White House reporter has had the courage to ask Bush, or for that matter, Scotty McClellan, whether this administration is spying on any Democrats. And
I agree.
And somebody should be asking that question. But they're all afraid that if they ask that question, they'll lose access to the White House, which means they'll lose their $250,000-a-year jobs as White House correspondents. And, it's the tragedy of the star culture in the media right now. Cheryl, thanks for the call. It's a good one. Vincent in Neshonoc, Pennsylvania. Am I pronouncing that right? Probably not. Hey, Vincent.
Neshonoc.
Uh-huh. Okay, great.
Hi. Tom, you're doing a good job. I like this. I listened to the State of the Denial and Self-Contradictions last night, and I would like to say just a few words about his energy policy.
What energy policy? Oh, you mean the $8 billion in taxpayer giveaways to ExxonMobil and other oil companies?
Exactly.
Yeah.
First of all, he talks about how we're addicted to oil. And I'd like to say that, really, he's the one that created energy policy. His right-hand man, Cheney, brought in people secretly, and they were from the private sector, and they wrote a policy that would give people like Halliburton billions of dollars on no-bid contracts. The second point is that we have a greater percentage of our oil now from dictatorships and cartels than we did in the year 2000. And thirdly, his administration has really created this environment that has allowed ExxonMobil Corporation to make more money last year, I don't know, $36 billion or whatever it was, than any other company in the history of the United States.
In the history of the world.
In the world, that's better yet. I didn't know
this is
that.
The history of the 7,000-year history of civilization.
Oh,
and
wow.
This, in large part, is a result of Ronald Reagan suspending the Sherman Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act, back in the early 80s,
mm-hmm.
so that these corporations could get so large.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely, Vincent. It is a crime and a travesty. Got to move along. Margaret in Everett, Washington. Hey, Margaret, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I've talked with you before, and you know my outrage every time our senators go and suck up to Republicans, and we're all outraged at our senator who voted yesterday for Tom Alito, and
Sam Alito.
Pardon?
Sam Alito, yeah. It was day before yesterday, but yeah.
Well, I get upset about all this.
There you go.
You know, and she still only has till the end of this year, and Murray has until 2008. But
right.
Maria is getting a lot of outrage here in this area, and I know some people in Seattle also. And then her finagling with the, Collins and these people, she's going to lose her seat this fall, I fear. And we do have another Democratic person that's going to be challenging her.
Yeah, Mark Wilson. In fact, he was on the program in the last hour.
I heard him. Yes.
Yeah. Mark Wilson's going to have to fight her in the primary. And let's just be candid here. The odds are incumbency is a very powerful thing, and the odds are she'll win that primary challenge. It's very, very rare that you have to have an incumbent senator who is who is like Tom DeLay unpopular to lose in a primary.
Yeah.
And so the odds are very, very high that Maria Cantwell is going to win the primary. And frankly, I think it would be a tragedy if she lost her seat, because that means a Republican would be sitting on it.
Well, I feel the same way. However, have you the things have been brought out this morning, how many times she has voted against us.
Well, hopefully the pressure from Mark Wilson being in the campaign will cause Maria Cantwell to realize that she's out of touch with her constituency.
Uh-huh. Well,
if she is. I mean, it may be that she's not. It may be that the majority of Washingtonians actually want her to behave like a Republican on many of these issues. And if that's the case, then I actually salute her, because I think that a representative should represent their district.
Not true on this Alito vote, because her phones were closed yesterday, both in Seattle and Everett, for taking messages against this when we started speaking out our outrage.
Yeah. Well, Margaret, over the short term, the thing that I would do if I lived in Washington State is I'd call Patty Murray and say thank you so much for voting to sustain the filibuster.
Yeah, I do that too.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you, Tom. At least I got my outrage out.
Okay. Good on you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Karen Ann in Grand Rapids. We're just about out of time here, Karen Ann. I think I'm going to have to hold you over. Hang on just a second. We'll take your call in just a minute. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. By the way, Cindy Sheehan, I got to tell you about this. So we've got this Cindy Sheehan's testimony about what Mike Waite, a guy, an officer, Capitol Police officer, Mike Waite, did to her, and how and why. I'll share that with you after we come back from the break, as well as your calls. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Was in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, when the road was full of mud. I come in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm.
Well, not if you come into the U.S. Capitol and you happen to be Cindy Sheehan. She wrote, my ticket was in the fifth gallery, fourth front row, fourth seat in. The person who in a few minutes was to arrest me helped me to my seat. I had just sat down, and I was warm from climbing three flights of stairs back up from the bathroom, so I unzipped my jacket. I turned to the right to take my left arm out when the same officer saw my shirt and yelled, protester! He then ran over to me and hauled me out of my seat and roughly, with my hands behind my back, shoved me up the stairs. I said something like, I'm going, do you have to be so rough? By the way, his name is Mike Waite, W-E-I-G-H-T. The officer ran with me to the elevators, yelling at everyone to move out of the way. Then we got to the elevators, he cuffed me and took me outside to await a squad car. On the way out, somebody behind me said, that's Cindy Sheehan. At which point, the officer who arrested me said, take these steps slowly. I said, you didn't care about being careful when you were dragging me up the other steps. He said, that's because you were protesting. Wow, I got hauled out of the people's house because I was protesting. She goes on to say, I was never told that I couldn't wear that shirt into the Congress. I was never asked to take it off or zip my jacket back up. If I had been asked to do any of those things, I would have, and written about the suppression of my freedom of speech later. I was immediately and roughly, I have the bruises and muscle spasms to prove it, hauled off and arrested for unlawful conduct. After I had my personal items inventoried, my fingers printed, a nice sergeant came in and looked at my shirt and said, 2245, huh? I just got back from there. Cindy Sheehan's T-shirt, by the way, said, 2245 dead, how many more? That's what it said on her T-shirt. I told him, back to quoting from Cindy Sheehan, she says, I told him that my son died there. That's when the enormity of my loss hit me. I have lost my son. I have lost my First Amendment rights. I have lost the country I love. Where did America go? I started crying in pain. Cindy Sheehan. It's over at truthout.org if you want to read it. It's probably on other websites as well. Back to Karen Ann in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Karen Ann.
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. Hopefully our nation will as well.
Yeah, this country will get better.
Yeah.
I thought I'd tell you a little something about the manipulation of statistics.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little market commentary that appeared on a Wells Fargo 401k report from my husband's former employer. He still has his 401k there.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this little market commentary. Economic Review, 2005, saw the U.S. economy continuing its expansion. GDP growth in the fourth quarter is projected at 3.5%, only a little slower than the 4.1% third quarter pace. The economy, and I love this one, the economy has now registered 11 consecutive quarters of growth above 3%. Wow.
Yeah. Karen Ann, I got to ask you to stop reading. It's we just kind of have a policy.
Okay, the Reagan administration. Okay.
Yeah.
Also, unemployment.
So what's your point? What's your point, Karen?
Well, it's the manipulation of statistics.
Oh, yeah.
Like the unemployment rate fell slightly to 4.9%.
Yeah, that's because the long-term unemployed went up.
As too many jobs were created, where are those jobs?
Right, yeah.
Have we ever recovered from 2001?
So Wells Fargo sent you out something with the Bush administration Republican talking points in it?
It sure sounds like it.
That's
average hourly earnings rose 0.3%. Big deal.
Yeah, well, in fact, we find in today's Wall Street Journal there was an article about how average hourly and salaried working earnings over the last year did not keep up with inflation last year. So
yeah, but this was notably faster than the Fed would prefer to see due to the higher potential for inflation. And I just heard during one of the breaks that the Fed is going to be increasing interest rates.
Yeah, they just yesterday
they
voted
just
to
did,
increase
yeah.
interest rates.
Uh-huh.
Karen Ann, thanks a lot for the call and sharing this with us. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
I just think it's important to point out that Mr. Bush and myself are two equal human beings, and we have entered into an agreement together, a contract. It's a contract that gave certain conditions under which he has his power, including the power to the ability to spy on me. And one of those abilities he can then push back on me, doesn't that create a violation of a contract?
Yeah, that contract being the Constitution and the laws of this country?
Well, yeah, he's broken.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly. And this is what Arlen Specter is actually supposed to be looking into this week and next in the Senate Judiciary Committee, is whether or not Bush was breaking laws. And amazing, you know, that Republicans are asking these questions, although I have a feeling that very quickly they're going to start speaking in squeaky voices.
Yeah, but would I ever sign a contract that allowed one of the signatories to invalidate the contract completely? I mean,
my guess is, Logan, you already have. Have you ever bought a car on time or bought a house mortgage?
Well, I agree with you in that sense, but I'm just saying, I mean, the Constitution cannot have a rule in it which allows somebody to invalidate it itself. It's almost contradictory.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Logan. Well said. Ken in Lacey, Washington, we just have 1 minute left. Hey, Ken.
That's not enough time. This is going to require more time than that. Sorry.
Seriously?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll take you some other time. Eric in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Good. How are you doing today, Tom?
I'm great. We just have a half a minute. What's up?
No, you know, with the deal with Seattle and the Democrats, I voted Democrat at most time, but we cannot keep – this is why we keep losing, is we just keep voting for the lesser of two evils. Just because somebody's a Democrat, the Democratic Party needs – or the country needs wholesale change. And as long as we just keep voting these people in because they have a big D in front of their name – It, in the long run, it hurts the whole cause.
I don't disagree with you, Eric, but I think that if enough progressives get involved in the Democratic Party and in Democratic politics, we'll start seeing progressive candidates, and we'll start seeing a lot of the candidates who are in there who maybe are just kind of going whichever way they think the wind is blowing, noticing that the wind is blowing in our direction.
Yeah, well...
We can hope, right? We can hope. But in the meantime, the one thing I don't want to do in the case in Washington, I realize you're in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but in Washington, I don't want to beat up Maria Cantwell to the point that she loses to a Republican. On the other hand, I'd like her to get it that, some of her constituents are not happy with what's going on. We'll see how this all shakes out. Because I think Maria Cantwell's a good person, fundamentally. And I think she's probably a fairly good senator for the state of Washington. And that ultimately is the bottom line. The same in Michigan. I mean, you know, Debbie Stabenow, I think she's a great senator, but I disagree with some of her votes. You guys, her and Senator Levin, you got to keep them. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour. You know, sometimes you know what's going on. Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't even know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't know what you need to know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible? Are major corporations and the government planning on tracking our every move? Liz McIntyre thinks so. She's written a book called Spy Chips. The website, spychips.com. Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with us. How are major corporations and the government planning to track our every move?
Well, with RFID, that stands for Radio Frequency Identification. And what it is it consists of tiny microchips. Some of these are smaller than a grain of sand with unique identification numbers on them. Now, these things are hooked up to little bitty antennas. I mean, these are very, very small. I mean, some of them are so small they could be embedded in paper, like currency, to track items remotely. They work by radio waves, like the ones people are listening to us on here today. And just like those radio waves go out through solid objects, these RFID radio waves travel through things like our purses, backpacks, wallets. They could travel through shirts and shoes, anything that has one of these microchips on it. And consider these are like social security numbers for things. And so this information could link up to databases, tell retailers and marketers an awful lot about us, and even the government could use it to track us, according to IBM.
Well, in fact, the government is already required to, aren't they? Isn't this part of the Real ID Act, that there have to be RFID chips in our passports and in our driver's licenses in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, so far, we're hoping that they don't do that. Of course, Homeland Security is setting the standards for the new national driver's licenses required by the Real ID Act. And they're so hot on this technology, Tom, that it would not surprise us. I found an RFP. In which they're trying
request to... Request for proposals.
Yes, absolutely. Where they're trying to get these tech people to come in and soup up the technology they're already using with U.S. Visit. And listen to this. They want to be able to track people from up to 25 feet away, okay, with little devices. It could be a driver's license. It could be any piece of paper. They want to be able to pinpoint where they are in a street, in a lane. They want to be able to read these things in cars speeding by at 55 miles an hour. Imagine, already this driver's license would be sort of a de facto national ID. Imagine it being a de facto national ID that's remotely readable without your knowledge or consent.
Right, and so if you happen to be in a protest demonstration and they just drive by with a scanner, bingo, they've got the names, addresses, social security numbers, conceivably medical histories and credit histories of every single person standing in that protest.
Absolutely, it's unbelievable, but it's true.
And in fact, if these things are the size of a grain of sand, it could be embedded in food you're eating. You wouldn't even know it. And for the 24 or 48 hours it takes for that food to pass through your body, wherever you go, they could scan you.
Yeah, these things can be incredibly small. And, of course, they have a little antenna connected with them. The bigger the antenna, the further things travel. But we've seen patent applications where they can make these things so stealthy. I mean, they can actually use threads in fabric as antennas, believe it or not. So you can have one of these things in the insole of your shoe with quite a large antenna that's flexible and invisible that could actually be picked up from quite a distance.
Interesting. So what's driving this? Is it the government's desire to be Big Brother, or is it Saks Fifth Avenue's, not to pick on them, but just to pull a name out of the air,
right.
Is it the desire of the retail industry to have that world from that Tom Cruise movie where you walk into the store and they know what parts of the store you browse through, they know what you buy, they know what stores you visited, they build a giant database so that this time when you walk up to the display it says, welcome Ms. McIntyre, last week you were here and you bought the pistachio ice cream cone, would you like the same thing again?
Well, clearly private enterprise is driving this, companies like Procter & Gamble, Walmart, Gillette, but the government is going along, especially now that they've seen all the potential. I mean, IBM has a patent application we spell out in our book, Spy Chips, and it's called Identification and Tracking of Persons Using RFID Tagged Items. of course, it talks about retailers being able to link up these unique identification numbers with people when they pay with an identifiable form of payment, like a credit card or an ATM card or a check. And then later, when those tags are seen in the environment, they could serve up spammed advertising, basically, either based on your purchase history or something you're wearing or carrying. But it goes beyond that, Tom, and IBM suggests using a person tracking unit. They actually call it that. And the government tracking
PTU.
In public places. Public places, they name them airports, train stations, bus stations, elevators, libraries, museums, and even restrooms. They say that in their sworn public documents.
Amazing. We're talking with Liz McIntyre. She's the author of Spy Chips, the website spychips.com. Liz, I noticed, I believe it was this morning, maybe it was yesterday, on one of the right-wing websites, I think it might have been Drudge, a headline, innocuous-seeming enough headline, that said something like, you know, a certain number of arrests credited to spy cameras in a particular city. My recollection is it was Baltimore, but I could be wrong. And it almost seems like we're being prepared for this. Like, you know, this, and in fact, England has already gone, you know, quite a ways down this road, have they not?
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, you can see it in our own cities. If you've driven through Houston recently, you'll see that there are these cameras at every street corner pretty much in the metropolitan area, and they can wheel around like robotic owls viewing, you know, almost every inch of pavement within half a mile and zoom in on people. So, you know, this is happening. It's like water rushing over the rocks, Tom. I mean, pretty soon, you know, those rocks get worn down and people get used to this. They're paving the way for a Big Brother surveillance society is what they're doing.
I would say, Liz, that Liz McIntyre with SpyChips.com, the author of the book Spy Chips, co-author of the book Spy Chips, that they're more than paving the way, that we are already pretty much there. I mean, the corporations now have the ability to share our personal data to the point where if you apply for car insurance, you know, they can check your medical history and, this person had a bout with alcoholism 5 years ago, or this person was on Prozac or whatever, and reject you or price you based on things that have nothing to do with your driving record, for example.
Absolutely.
Or if you want to get a mortgage, I mean, they're looking at these things.
Absolutely. It's unbelievable. A lot of people don't know how bad it's already gotten, but it's just going to get worse. And, of course, the private enterprise is collecting those. The government would not be able to do it, but now they're buying it from private enterprise and
right.
sifting through it. And we know one day they're going to get a hold of these RFID tag numbers if we let this go forward. And Tom, you know, the next increment of this, and they're getting ready for this, is actually implanting these RFID devices in our flesh. As you may know, there's already a company called Verichip.
Yeah, Bill Bennett, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
No. There was one former member of the Bush administration. No, it's Tommy. What's his name?
Tommy Thompson.
Tommy Thompson,
Secretary
Thank
of
you.
Health and Human Services.
And he said he was going to get one implanted, but he never did.
Never did. Supposedly he's going to do it, and there's some big splash coming up here. But you know, they don't hire so many big bucks like that. With tentacles in Washington for nothing. I mean, this guy is getting ready to have everything, have these things implanted in us. And he went on national TV saying that every American should get one linked to his medical record, and is talking about replacing military dog tags with these. They've actually been in contact and talking with the Pentagon about this.
Well, then you get the other side. You get the Bush side, basically, or the corporate side, saying, why should you worry about us knowing all this about you? Why, you know, wouldn't it be convenient for the military to be able to scan a battlefield and know what soldiers are where, or if you have dead, be able to know who they are, or if there are body parts after a 9/11 type incident, be able to know whose they are? Why should you worry about retailers knowing what your preferences are? Don't you already gladly tell Amazon.com what you bought in hopes that they'll serve up better books for you next time?
Well, you know, I think to put you in the right mindset for what this might do to you psychologically, mm-hmm. it's a good idea to reread 1984. I don't know if you've read that recently.
I reread it about 3 years ago, yeah.
Isn't it unbelievable? It puts you in that mindset of how does that feel to be tracked everywhere you go, and it doesn't feel good. And I think a lot of people flippantly say, oh, who cares, you know. But, you know, we don't leave our bathroom doors open for a reason. You know, we don't open our purses to people, and we don't walk around with our social security numbers on our T-shirts for a purpose.
Yeah.
We want to have some form of privacy to protect ourselves. It's a security thing. in addition.
Well, and there's a larger factor here, too, and that is that when this information, when information about us becomes ubiquitous, I mean, we just saw this with the sale of all these cell phone numbers, then our own ability to be personally safe is diminished, safe from predators in our own society.
Absolutely, and of course, as a society to be safe. I mean, right now you may say, hey, I trust the government, you know, let them have my information, but you never know who's going to be in there and who's going to be on the other end of that leash.
Right.
You know, right now it might be, you know, George Bush, but, you know, tomorrow it could be, you know, I don't know, Lindy England. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't trust anybody with that kind of a noose, and, you know, most people don't like the idea of it.
And it's not just the government. It's corporate America as well. I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, the insurance companies, I went to a dentist the other day, and I had to sign a form saying that they could release all my medical records to anybody they wanted
for any purpose at all.
They could sell them even.
Isn't that unbelievable? I mean, you know, and these RFID devices that are coming down the pike, as we spell it in our book, I mean, it's unbelievable. They can track you in milliseconds everywhere you go. They want to put these things in our homes and our refrigerators, believe it or not.
Yeah. Liz McIntyre with SpyChips.com, the new book Spy Chips, co-authored by Liz McIntyre and Catherine Albrecht. Liz, thanks for being with us.
Well, Tom, thank you.
It's a good wake-up call.
It sure is.
We need a lot more of it. Much appreciated. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, the place where smart people get their news.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
We'd like some freedom. Welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartmann radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Larry Scott's with us from VAWatchdog.org. Larry, the State of the Union for Veterans.
The State of the Union for Veterans, Tom, is not very good. And I would like to point out that for the second year in a row now, President Bush did not mention veterans in his State of the Union address.
Why might that be, Larry? I mean, there's tremendous political mileage to be gotten from sucking up to veterans. Why did the president pass on this opportunity?
Well, the president passed on veterans because what he has done is he's attached himself quite firmly to the troops. As we saw last night, his mention of the troops who are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also the family of the young soldier who unfortunately was killed serving his country, the one who was stood up and was applauded. And the real concept here, if you talk to people who are media savvy, they will tell you it's a whole lot easier to praise the dead than it is to deal with the living.
Yeah.
So by attaching yourself to those who have served their country and those who have given their life for their country, and by praising those people, there is a tremendous amount of media mileage. But when it comes to living veterans, those who've served, those who've come back perhaps with broken bodies and broken minds, that costs money to take care of those people, and that's really what it boils down to, Tom. It's just a matter of money, and I believe the president hasn't mentioned veterans for the last couple of years because of their efforts to cut the budget at the Veterans Administration and because of ongoing underfunding issues there, veterans waiting for sometimes 24 to 36 months to get necessary surgeries.
We had in the first hour of this program, Larry, of a vet. He'd served two tours of duty in Iraq as a member of the National Guard. He's a truck driver in Texas. He called in from his truck in Texas, and he was talking about how he's being financially wiped out because he was not able to earn a living while he was in Iraq. You know, the pay that he got as a guardsman certainly didn't cover his bills. He's got five different creditors threatening to shut him down right now, including the guy who owns his truck or who owns the note on his truck, and the bank that owns the note on his home. And he's like, what can I do? You know, and in fact, he said, you know, he tried to get out of the reserve, and they told him that he couldn't. He was forced to reenlist because of the stop loss program. He couldn't get out.
Right. There's about.
So,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, so what does a guy like this do?
Unfortunately, there's not much that a person like that can do right now. Technically, there are programs that are supposed to protect your job as a person who's called up for active duty and then comes back home. But for an independent contractor or the small business owner, a person who might have a small business as a sole proprietor, which I'm going to assume this veteran has,
yeah,
as a truck driver,
yeah,
there are no protections. There are none whatsoever. And the fact that you may take a huge cut in salary when you go, there are no programs to make up that difference. we find a very small number of industries, and you don't hear about them that often, but a very small number will help protect people who are called up by making up the difference in their salaries between what they get from the Guard and Reserve and what they used to get back home.
Yeah, I'm actually on the board of a private school in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and our schoolmaster, our headmaster, the guy who runs the school, is in the National Guard, got called up, got sent to Iraq, and we made up the spread between his National Guard salary and his salary at the school. But
you can probably count on both hands the number of companies in this country that are doing that right
well,
now.
Well, we had one guy who was in the Guard, and it's right. a small organization, you know, with maybe a $3 million a year budget and you know, 40 employees is not a big deal, but
right.
In any case.
You talked about the state of the Veterans Union. What we have just found out also, and this is not going to be good news for many veterans, I'm afraid, and that is coming out of the White House. White House aides and congressional aides have been putting their heads together on the new veterans budget, which we will get on the afternoon of February 6th. And that is, once again this year, the Bush administration is going to push for the big three, as we call it, enrollment fees for the VA. That's where you have to pay an annual fee to be seen by a doctor. Also, deductibles.
Now, the enrollment, just right off the top, the enrollment fees are going to wipe out all your homeless vets.
Yes, absolutely. And then deductibles, where you'll have to pay a deductible to see not only a primary care provider, but a specialist, and also increased copays, taking the prescription copay from $8 a month up to $15 a month, at least $15. So the big three are back on the table this year from the Bush administration for many, many veterans, and that is enrollment fees, deductibles, and copays. They're going to try to push it through Congress again this year, Tom.
I have to assume, Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, Larry Scott, the chief cook and bottle washer there for the website.
That works.
What's your official title, Larry?
I just call myself the coordinator. I'm
okay,
the guy.
Coordinator, that's right. And I have to assume that the word of this malfeasance on the part of the Bush administration is working its way down to the active duty troops. We have about a half a minute left. How what's the word on the street?
The word on the street from the troops is they're upset about this. They're angry. They not only they have a lot of sympathy and empathy for the brothers and sisters who've gone before them in battle, but they know what they have to look forward to, and it's not good right now. And they just really fear coming back.
And they fear going over there in the first place, too. I mean,
yes, but they and a lot of them are already saying the emails I get from overseas tell me, we know what's going on back there when it comes to the VA and health care. We fought our battle here. Now we have to come back home. We've got to fight another battle with the VA to get our health care.
Yeah, courtesy of the Bush administration.
Right.
Amazing. Larry Scott, a member of the VFW, the coordinator for the VAWatchdog.org website. Check it out, VAWatchdog.org. Larry, thanks a lot for being with
us. Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the good work on behalf of the veterans here in the United States.
Thanks.
27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The warmth of your love is like the warmth of the sun, and this will be our year. Took a long time to come.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman Radio Program, a true people's radio. We have with us Chris Hansen, a senior ACLU staff attorney. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I wanted to get your take on this. Last night we had two people arrested and dragged out of the out of Congress as before leading up to Bush giving his State of the Union speech. One was Beverly Young, the wife of Republican Congressman Bill Young of Florida, who chairs the House Defense Appropriations Panel, and she was wearing a T-shirt that said "Support the Troops Defending Our Freedom." And she says that she was six rows away from Laura Bush when she was asked to leave. And she says they considered her shirt a protest. She responded, "Then you're an idiot." And then they dragged her out anyway or made her leave. And then Cindy Sheehan, of course, was thrown out. Cindy Sheehan was up in the gallery. This woman was not in the gallery, this congressman's wife. She was down in the front area. What's the deal here? What's legal, what's not?
Well, the answer is neither the facts nor the answer to your question are terribly clear, but let me sort of give you the overall outline. It is very clear that government does not have the authority to discriminate against speakers on the basis of viewpoint. So that the most interesting part about this story is that both a support the troops and an anti-war t-shirt resulted in people being ejected. That's different than the pattern we've seen in prior instances. We have two pending cases, one in West Virginia and one in Denver, in which people were ejected from Bush events, from the audience of Bush events, for wearing anti-Bush t-shirts. And only anti-Bush t-shirt people were ejected. This one at the Capitol appears to be slightly different than that, but it's our view that, of course, ejecting someone on the basis of viewpoint is about as unconstitutional as you can probably get.
Well, it appears, given that there were two different viewpoints here, that people were ejected for simply engaging in some relatively passive form of free speech. Is that not guaranteed by the First Amendment?
It is guaranteed by the First Amendment, but not in every possible location. For example, you probably don't have a right to walk down to the FBI lab and insist that you go into the most hygienic part of the FBI lab, you know, carrying your signs and doing your demonstrations.
Sure.
So the Supreme Court has developed a fairly elaborate process for deciding where you are allowed to demonstrate and where you aren't allowed to demonstrate. What is interesting about the Capitol case is the assumption by the Capitol Police that wearing a T-shirt all by itself is, in fact, a demonstration. It is somewhat to their credit that they ejected both pro-Bush people and anti-Bush people. But nevertheless, the notion that a solitary human being wearing a T-shirt is somehow demonstrating seems a bit of a stretch. I mean, I wonder if there were anybody in the audience wearing a T-shirt with a commercial logo on it, like Coca-Cola or Mickey Mouse, and whether they would have been ejected on the basis that that was some sort of, quote, demonstration, unquote.
Well, that's an interesting concept. So Cindy Sheehan says that she's going to try and hire a lawyer and fight this thing. She says that nobody even, that she would have covered the T-shirt up if anybody had simply asked her to. But she wasn't given that opportunity, that she was dragged out, physically dragged out, and pushed up a flight of stairs and down another flight of stairs with her hands behind her back and ultimately handcuffed. Without even literally being given the opportunity to cover up the T-shirt. What's the legal status of that?
Well, there are two things about that. One is the notion that somehow it's acceptable to go ahead and suppress her speech. If in fact she had the right to wear the T-shirt, then, you know, she shouldn't have to cover it up.
Right.
At the same time, it does seem to me that if the government was offended by the T-shirt, and if it was legitimately offended by the T-shirt, which I think we should be skeptical of, then to simply arrest her without giving her a chance seems also improper. Now, the counter to that, and what I would expect the government would argue, is even if she covers it up at the beginning of the speech, they fear that she will uncover it somehow during the speech, and they don't want the Capitol Police don't want to have to haul her out in the middle of the speech, thus drawing everybody's attention. But I frankly don't find that very persuasive.
Yeah. So ultimately, do you think this Cindy Sheehan case, or for that matter, the Beverly Young case, that these are the kind of cases that will become cases? I mean, is there?
I think there's a fair chance that this will result in litigation, and if Representative Young's wife wants to call the ACLU, we'd be happy to talk to her about representing her. As with respect to Ms. Sheehan, we've litigated this issue in two other locations in the country where at Bush events, the administration has insisted on removing anyone in the audience who didn't agree with the president.
Yeah.
I think this raises some more complicated issues because it's not the same kind of public setting as those events were. But I think the First Amendment issues are important and deserve to be litigated.
Well, and you wonder, okay, at what point does it stop being for example, somebody's wearing a lapel pin with a flag on it. Is that an emblem of some kind? Speaking of Chris Hansen, senior ACLU staff attorney, and Chris, just real quickly before you go, one last question. Brett Bercy, are you familiar with his case?
I am.
He was arrested for carrying a no war for oil sign in the midst of Bush pro-Bush protesters or pro-Bush whatever you call them. demonstrators, I guess, who were holding pro-Bush signs. He was told that the reason he was being arrested was because of the content of his sign. He was singled out. His case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declined to hear his case, which left his conviction stand.
Mm-hmm.
Does he have any recourse? I mean, is that going to go anywhere?
No, at this point he doesn't have any recourse. But what I think is worth mentioning is that the district court found that the facts were very different than you just recited them.
Uh-huh.
Found that,
okay,
in fact, the reason he was arrested was not because of his sign, but because he was in an area that the Secret Service had deemed too close proximity to the president.
But this was still outside. This was physically outside the building in which the president was located.
Yeah, I wasn't there, and I don't know what the facts are. All I can tell you is the district court found that he was inside an area in which no people were allowed, whether they were pro or anti-Bush, and that it was an area that was legitimately close enough to the president that it was legitimate for the Secret Service to keep people out. Again, I wasn't there. I don't know what the actual facts are. I don't know who's.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite different from the story that he told us on this program.
Yeah, and he may be right and the district court may be wrong. I'm not suggesting the contrary. But I think part of the reason the case ended up not succeeding is that the district court made all those findings.
Yeah, interesting. Chris Hansen, senior attorney with the ACLU. Thanks so much for being with us, Chris.
My pleasure.
Much appreciated.
And
thanks for coming on. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 41 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Gail in Lewiston, Maine on the line. Hey, Gail, welcome to the program.
Hi. I've been listening to all the different topics. I was going to call up about health insurance, but there's been so many different topics while I've been waiting.
Well, I noted, according to the software here, you lived in Canada and the healthcare system works there great.
Yeah.
There? Tell us
about
that.
Yeah, in the mid-70s, I lived there as a landed immigrant for a couple of years, and I was covered under their system. And, you know, it seemed good to me then. I don't know what problems they've had since then, but, you know, it's not connected to your job. It's through the government, so if you change jobs, you don't have to worry about losing your health insurance.
Right.
And I didn't find that I had to wait excessively to see a doctor.
Yeah.
Went to a doctor and I had some tests on my stomach, and I'm just wondering, like, we always hear all the bad things about the Canadian health system and other countries that have, like, universal coverage. I wonder, you know, why we don't get to hear. There must be good things about it.
There are, and usually usually it's callers in Canada who are calling in and saying, hey, you know, we're just fine with this. I lived in Vermont for 10 years. I don't recall, you know, an invasion of Canadians coming over to the border to see doctors in Vermont. I never had to, you know, wait to see a doctor in Vermont because the Canadians were there. On the other hand, in Vermont, people were organizing bus tours, senior citizens, to go up to Canada to get prescription drugs because they were cheaper. So, you know, a significant difference, I'd say, there. And then our government was saying, oh, no, you have to buy those drugs here because the drugs are not safe in Canada. And I don't recall, you know, Canadians dropping dead over the border from having taken Canadian
drugs. Well, you know, I had LASIK surgery for my nearsightedness in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
My father wanted to give it to me as a present, and I didn't want to cost him too much money, so it was like one-third of the cost of having it done here.
Yeah, I understand that that's the case. Gail, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. Mark in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Mark Frankenberg with Just Say No to Fascism.com. This presidential State of the Union address last night was alarming. The idea that he can cover his tracks with this NSA spying on the U.S. citizens by introducing a new terrorist surveillance program.
Right.
What's going on with that? Also, these undeclared wars. Congress has not declared war on Iran, and yet he's rattling his saber for an attack on Iran.
Oh, I know. He seems to think that as a result of 9/11, that he has the right to attack anybody, anywhere, anytime he wants, because a resolution was passed in the week, I believe, right after 9/11, that authorized the president to use whatever means necessary to protect the American people. It was a very vaguely worded thing, and he thinks he was crowned emperor. You know,
he's
King George. It's the third George to rule the United States, George Washington Bush the senior, and now junior, and this third George thinks he's King George the third.
That's undermining the Constitution. That's not what our republic is all about.
Yeah, well said, Mark. Well said.
We need to lock arms and set up some kind of canary warning system among the citizens because they're wiring us up for...
Yeah, the canary warning system, Mark, in part is this program and in part is your website, justsayno2fascism.org.
Just say no to fascism.com.
.com. Okay, great. Mark, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll continue with us right after this break. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where being progressive never felt so good.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. I'm the place where smart people get their news. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. 1-866-440-8466. Our phone number, Stuart in Hollywood, Florida, on the line. Hey, Stuart, what's up?
How are you? Let me just say this. I saw a great bumper sticker yesterday. It's, I want you to know where I'm coming from. It said, impeach Cheney first.
Right.
So I want you to know I'm a big... I'm a big anti-Republican. I never will vote for a Republican in my life.
Okay.
That said, I was puking, vomiting all over my lap last night when I saw this nerd, Governor Tim Kaine. The Democrats are so stupid, they never miss a chance to miss a chance.
I know. I know.
This guy with a wandering eyebrow. I thought it was The Rock.
I know. It was a caterpillar. It was moving over his face.
That's the worst. I mean, so they throw fresh meat out there, okay,
I know,
to tell a stale story. All the guy did, I'm telling you, when I have to agree with a creep like John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, he says here in my newspaper, the Miami Herald, Democrats claim that there's a better way, but what is it? Amen. I mean, look, I believe that the average American is a moronic, beer-swilling sloth, and the Republicans know it, and the Democrats still haven't learned that. That said, all this guy had to say was, hey, we're for tax cuts, but for the middle class. We want to take those tax cuts for the rich who were doing well in the Clinton years and didn't need a tax break and give it to the middle class so that they'll spend it and stimulate the economy.
Yeah.
That's
not well said, Stuart. I mean, just straight, solid, bam, bam talking points. Instead, the reason that they got Kaine on was because he won in Virginia, I believe it was, based on a platform of I'm religious, therefore vote for me, in large part. And you got the Bob Schrum consultants in the Democratic Party going, well, people seem to like candidates who are religious, so let's get this guy on. And I'm like, you know, come on. That should not be the criteria. I agree with you absolutely. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Not even that. Just recite the record.
Yeah.
Just recite the successes and achievements and say, who do you trust, man? We don't have to give a new plan. Just look at the track record.
Yeah, and this we've got a better way. Come on.
Just look at record, compare, kick the tires. Who do you trust?
The Democrats won World War II in less time than Bush has been in Iraq.
Yeah, and why didn't he say these health savings accounts? Hello? Americans have the lowest savings rate since the Republican Great Depression.
Well, in fact, we went to negative savings this last year, half of 1% down. People are actually going into their savings simply to stay alive.
Did the dumb Democrats mention that in the rebuttal?
No.
Oh, my God. It's hopeless.
Well, it's not hopeless. It's as long as you and I still have some air in our lungs, Tom, it's not hopeless. We'll keep going on it. We'll keep on it. I appreciate the call. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Tom. Always good to speak with you. Last night in the State of the Union, I heard Bush again defend, justify, and promote his domestic spying program, which chills me to the bone, Tom, because I know the software they're using. I had interviewed these people that manufacture the software called Autonomy for use in the corporate world, and what it can do to relate it to you as a person. Let's say you decide to go to Germany for a week. You've got a lot of projects going on your radio program, and you need someone that's with your equal skills but can follow along with everything you're doing, all the guests you intend to have, etc. Well, using the Autonomy software, someone can sit down with your equivalent skills and look at every email you've done by subject and filter it for different criteria, all of your voicemails, all of the web pages you've seen, all of the text you've entered into the computer, no matter which application you used. It will crawl 3 terabytes of data within 8 hours and fully concatenate the information so the person coming on to do your show would be completely, absolutely prepared.
So it could create a clone of me.
pretty much make a clone of you by allowing the technology to fill in all the back office kind of stuff.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, this is where we're at, Scott, and this is why instead of having a president who's running around saying, "Oh, we need we're dealing with old laws here. We need new laws because of technology that make it easier for us to spy on people." We need a president who's going to say, "You know, we because of the changes in technology, we need new laws that are going to protect us from this kind of spying." Thanks a lot, Scott. Good to hear from you, Kenny in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, I was just wondering about, I'm a first-time listener. I just got XM Radio, but I'm enjoying your show. I just wanted to know what the gentleman that was a senior analyst meant by saying that, by George Bush saying that they weren't going to cut and run, that he's just going to do it. I don't understand. I think the people will be all over that. I mean, I'm a U.S. Marine. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to know when we're heading up out of there. I work a lot with some generals and some higher ups.
Well, I understand actually our troops have been reduced by about 20% over the last couple of months. My take on
That's
it
correct.
is that the Bush administration is following the MRTHA plan. They're just going to call it victory. They're going to do what I forget who it was now suggested to Richard Nixon way back when. Why don't you just declare victory and come home? You know, and my take on it is that that's what we're going to see happen. David in Blaine, Washington, we have less than a minute. David, what's up?
Oh, no problem. Liberal progressives have to now set their sights on the House Judiciary Committee and that Sensenbrenner, because the new provisions tucked into the Patriot Act before Congress right now would allow authorities to haul demonstrators at special events.
Yeah, that's this whole designation of SENS, these new special events that don't require the president to be there, and the Secret Service can still go in and arrest you.
Oh, my God. And the Bush soundbites from last night will live in infamy. I mean, he is the product of vote fraud, and we can thank the Supreme Court for this.
Yeah, well said. Ken and thank you, David. Ken and Lacey, Washington, very, very quickly.
Well, you know, we need to contact our representatives about what happened to Cindy Sheehan. I called my senators in Washington, and they said that, CNN and the AP has a different story. They said
yeah, right. Well, and in fact, CNN did say she unfurled a banner, and CNN was simply wrong. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, it's Groundhog's Day. Conservative Richard Morrison wants to abolish pensions. And Robbie Bodger is going to tell us about the Greenspan fraud over the last 20 years. In the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.